from the Department. And the essence of it is, in this hearing, what we're doing is we're focusing particularly on gathering information concerning the circumstances which led to the release of information from parliamentary information and security systems to the authors of the inquiry. Today, we're speaking to some of the key SDG individuals involved in this release, those who were involved with the request, those who responded. So that's what we were doing on the 21st of August. We've not been asked to investigate this matter as a contempt. Our overall aim is not to establish personal culpability or hold individuals to account. We're looking at this matter in detail only insofar as it's a practical example of how the policies and procedures which govern the access and release of information from parliamentary information and security systems are to be applied. We expect the information to gather will help inform us about where the main issues in this area lie, whether there are problems with the policies and the procedures themselves, and if so, what the gaps are, or whether the problem has arisen due to their application. So we're quite a long way down the track, but it's helpful just to emphasise those points to you this morning as we begin this part of the committee's deliberations. Over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm accompanied by Dr. Matthew Palmer this morning and this afternoon. I'd like to make a brief statement, then perhaps take some questions, if that's acceptable.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, the Henry Inquiry established the dates of the 27th of March to the 9th of April as being the dates critical to its investigation. That inquiry was commissioned by the chief executives of the DPMC and the GCSB, but was to be carried out independently of both agencies. It was serviced by an official from the DPMC. The inquiry was established on the 15th of April 2013. My first meeting with Mr. Henry was not until 23 May, when he advised me that he was interested in the period 27 March to 9 April only, and that events outside that period of time were not part of his inquiry. The inquiry's terms of reference included reviewing communications and copying equipment and records, logbooks and any other material considered relevant of those who had access to the Kitteridge report. Emails released by the DPMC show that on the 8th of May, the inquiry requested cell phone records and external mail data for ministers, but excluding me. Ministerial services then indicated that such information could be provided for the relevant ministers, including me. However, Parliamentary Service asked for written confirmation from individual ministers before authorising access to those records. I'm unsure why I was excluded from the original list of ministers whose records the inquiry sought, while being on the list of names that Ministerial Services said information could be obtained for. In any event, no request was ever made to me by Parliamentary Services, Ministerial Services, or the inquiry seeking authorisation to access my data. Yet, when I met Mr. Henry on the 23rd of May, he was able to tell me of the number of emails that Andrea Vance and I had exchanged between the 27th of March and the 9th of April. At the same meeting, he sought my approval, which I declined on privacy grounds, to access the full content of those emails. I further advised him that I did not have Ms. Vance's approval to release her emails, a point which Mr. Henry disputed. On 31 May, he told me that under employment law, there was no legal reason why I could not release her emails to me. Yet this contradicted his advice to me at the 23 May meeting, that the very reason he needed my approval to access the content of my emails was because ministers were not considered to be employees and therefore were not subject to normal employment law. What is clear is that at no point did the inquiry have my authorisation to access even my email metadata, let alone the content of my emails. Yet I now know from information released by the DPMC on the 2nd of August that all my inwards and outwards email metadata to my parliamentary inbox, not just those relating to Ms. Vance and me, but all my email data for the period 22 March to 15 April was provided to the inquiry and to the DPMC on the 16th of May. Moreover, the email trail released by the DPMC on the 2nd of August shows that a file containing the full emails between Ms. Vance and me had been provided by a Parliamentary Services contractor to the inquiry on the 21st of May. It was returned unopened, according to the inquiry, approximately 45 minutes later, following advice from Parliamentary Services that it had been forwarded an error. However, that file had also been available on the Parliamentary Service server for some 5 hours 35 minutes earlier that day. It is not clear whether the file was accessed during that time, and if so, by whom. I have written separately to Mr. Speaker seeking his assurance that the emails were not accessed by any staff member of or contract to the Parliamentary Service during that time, but I am yet to receive a reply. Later in the 23 May meeting, Mr. Henry asked me about a telephone conversation with Ms. Vance on the evening of 15 April, outside the period of time he had previously nominated as being the only dates he was interested in. I am now aware that on the 17th of May, Parliamentary Services had provided the inquiry and the DPMC with my full mobile phone records for the period 25 March to 25 April. At no point was my approval sought by anyone for access to those records. On 31 May, Mr. Henry requested access to my office landline data with specific reference to calls to Ms. Vance's office landline, office extension and mobile number for the period 27 March to 9 April. As I was overseas between 30 March and 7 April, I was prepared to agree to this request. I distinctly recall his saying that he wanted them for the purposes of comparison. This strongly suggests to me he had already viewed Ms. Vance's phone records. Emails released by the DPMC on the 2nd of August also make it clear Ms. Vance's phone records have been provided to the inquiry for a 3-month period. I do not know the period of time over which my records were provided. At the same meeting, Mr. Henry requested my swipe card records for 7 April. I agreed, solely because I was returning to New Zealand that day, so was nowhere near the parliamentary complex. I am now aware that my swipe card records were provided to the inquiry and the DPMC for 3 days, 6 to 8 April. In summary, therefore, my email metadata and mobile phone records were accessed without my approval. My swipe card details were provided for a period longer than that to which I had agreed. And while my landline records were accessed with my approval, I do not know for what period of time or whether records of all my calls other than those to Ms. Vance were handed over. Overall, this is a very unsatisfactory situation for the following reasons. The protocols governing access to ministers' electronic data are at best unclear and at worst non-existent. In this instance, what existing protocols there were clearly unknown to most of the agencies involved and applied in a very haphazard way. The inquiry was established by the DPMC and the GCSB, but conducted independently of both. Yet critical data relating to me personally, and presumably similar data relating to other persons of interest to the inquiry, was either obtained by or provided to the DPMC, apparently during the period of the inquiry. The DPMC says that it had not shared such data with any other organisation or entity, including the Prime Minister or his office. It is not clear to me why the DPMC, as one of the commissioning agencies of an apparently independent inquiry, was being provided with data relevant to that inquiry, apparently during the period of the inquiry. Despite Mr. Henry being specific that his focus was the period 27 March to 9 April, the information appears to have been provided on an almost random basis for a range of dates between at least 25 March and 25 April, and quite possibly wider. Again, the reason for this is unclear. Little or no regard was given by the inquiry or any of the agencies involved to legal rights of privacy or confidence in terms of communications between members of Parliament and the general public, including constituents, journalists, political and confidential contacts, and others. In my case, my email metadata and mobile phone records covered all my emails and phone calls for the period 22 March to 25 April, well beyond the scope and the period of interest identified by the inquiry. Nor was there any right, or regard rather, for members of Parliament's basic right to freedom of movement, speech and privacy in and around the parliamentary precincts. It was, for example, possible for the inquiry to determine from my swipe card records the frequency of my visits to the toilet. Under Section 26 of the Parliamentary Service Act 2000, control and administration of the parliamentary precincts are vested with the Speaker. Even the police need a protocol with the Speaker to exercise policing powers within parliamentary precincts. The privileges and immunities of the House of Representatives to control parliamentary precincts, to ensure freedom of speech of members, and in particular to resist the demands of executive government, are matters that are core to the constitutional position of Parliament. These principles were hard fought and won in Westminster centuries ago and inherited by our House of Representatives. Mr. Chairman, they must not be lightly cast away. I saw via a live stream the evidence that he gave. I don't think there is, actually. I think that in a number of instances, and those I referred to in my statement, contacts with members of the public, be they constituents, advisers, journalists, or otherwise, I think, and this was really the point of principle on which I resigned, was I think that there is a right to confidentiality of those communications. I think there's a legitimate expectation on the part of those with whom the communication occurs, that unless otherwise acknowledged, those communications will not be disclosed to the public.
But isn't there an equally important public interest in the processes of cabinet being able to occur with a high degree of confidence, confidentiality, particularly when they're dealing with issues as sensitive in relation to these subjects, and that where there are leaks of sensitive documents and you're going to have an inquiry into where they occur, surely it's an onus on ministers, including those who are at the state, that if there's going to be an inquiry, that it shouldn't just be on ministerial status or on public servants, but it should actually be on ministers as well.
Well, I think
I understand there's a differentiation between us that have roles as a member of parliament as a minister, and that they are separate. But in terms of roles as a minister, shouldn't it be within the gambit of ministerial services and the prime minister to be able to inquire, including into the actions of ministers, for him to be able to have confidence as the person who's ultimately responsible for the integrity of government?
Well, that's really what this particular inquiry is about, in determining where those boundaries should be. I've put forward a view as to where I see the boundary being drawn, and I think that I would come down on the side of an absolute protection of the rights of communication. But frankly, I'm not sitting around this committee table. I'm not hearing all of the evidence. That's something you've got to resolve ultimately and put in place, I think, clear rules. I think the clear lesson of this particular case has been that such rules as there were unclear, that those who were charged with administering them didn't quite know where the boundaries were, and that a lot of the problems that apparently occurred were as a result of that uncertainty. I think some greater clarity would be helpful.
But can I be clear with you? Do you accept there's any difference in the rights of a member of parliament to absolute rights as compared with a member of the executive, or are you put into the foot of this committee that those rules should be absolutely the same?
Well, I think where ministers are concerned in relation to the exercise of their portfolio responsibility, there are obviously certain restrictions that need to apply. But we have a very diverse parliament where members perform a variety of roles, and I think that to protect the right of communication as a member of parliament, as a party leader, roles that are not ministerial, I think that's very important to protect those rights. If you start to draw absolute boundaries, then you'll get to a position ultimately where no one will dare contact a member of parliament for fear of the disclosure of the information that they provide to the member of parliament, which I think would be something we'd all say is utterly wrong.
Could I just ask you to clarify, you see that you didn't play a time through this, that you declined, if I'm correct, full access of defence or remarks to the hearing process. Am I correct to assume there at no time you provided any emails or part of emails to the hearing?
No, I offered Mr. Henry, it would be around the 31st of May, access to an edited version of my emails, but not the responses to them, and I took out references that were clearly not relevant to the matters he was interested in. And that's recorded in his report.
The reason why I ask is I'm aware that you've articulated a principle of absolute privacy. I would ask you how you would reconcile that with providing the rule of absolute privacy as you do today. You've provided an edited version. I suppose the question goes to this is that presumably the only objective of the hearing inquiry was to ascertain the link. And if full information, if you provided full information and full emails to the hearing inquiry, there was no interest, I assume, in the hearing inquiry publishing or making public any peripheral issues of any kind that may form part of the emails that you provided and you provided them in totality. So, in doing so, you could have cleared yourself by providing the full information and still protected the content or the other issues that are otherwise that may have formed part of that disclosure. But I just find it difficult to reconcile how you can, on the one hand, support absolute privacy as a principle, but provide edited narrative on the other.
I think the short answer to the question is, well, twofold. Firstly, I think that's getting a little bit beyond the scope of the inquiry. But the second point, and substantively, I would say that I made the call because of his persistence, really, in simply saying, I must have access to the full emails. He said that on a number of occasions. I was not prepared to go down that path for the reasons that I've stated publicly. I felt the compromise was to give him access to a version of my emails which contained their main substance. He found that unsatisfactory, and that's where the cards fell. But I would not. The point I'd make, Mr. Cosgrove, is that in that instance, the call was mine, because it was my material. But I think as a general principle, I would come back to the absolute privacy of those communications.
So, is it your view that if you had taken the decision to provide the secretary all the information you sought in the secretary, that that would have lifted any question over yourself as the...
I think that's getting into territory that's beyond the scope of the inquiry.
Yeah, not, I come back to my preliminary statement that focusing on we're not setting out the findings to get the contemporary. Well, I was making an accusation. I was just
no. Look, I can just make this observation that I didn't make the call to withhold access lightly, but over 20 years ago, I drafted what became the Privacy Act. I have a very strong interest in protecting personal privacy and making sure that information gathered about people is not misused. And I guess in the end, that principle, to my cost, frankly, but that principle was the one that I fell back on.
But it's not an absolutist, well, it can't be an absolutist principle. If you look at the, I don't know, there's a security policy for parliamentary precincts, and it deals with access to recorded images under the CCTV system that's operating around here. But even there, that material can be released for security or safety questions or other permissible. Recording images following a security or criminal incident. So that information, which is in a similar category to access records, at least can be released in certain circumstances. Mm.
And I wouldn't argue with that in those circumstances.
No, I'm just sorry, slightly. So it's the rationale for you partially releasing material, as I understand your response, is purely motivated by the security systems.
Yes, correct. Correct.
So the principle of privacy sort of went out the door because we had the pressure. I agree with you,
No, I wouldn't agree with your choice of words, but I'd say this is beyond the scope of the inquiry, but my point was simply that faced with someone who wouldn't take no for an answer, I tried to be magnanimous. Yeah, I wouldn't use the words that you used because I don't think it's quite as all-encompassing as that. I think it comes down, as someone once said in another context, to the hats that people wear. And people do wear a series of hats and different hats at different times. And it's a matter of...
If you're a minister and you write emails on your ministerial computer that show, and I'm not saying you did because you're not a trial, but if you were a minister and you wrote emails on your ministerial diary, showed that documents were being leaked to someone. That seems to me that you can't prevent access to that just because you're...
No, and in that hypothetical instance, I would agree with you. But the point I would make, again, we're getting off the point, but the point I would make is that all of the emails in question were on the parliamentary server.
Well, they
were not at the ministerial... They were on the parliamentary address... No, what I mean by that, Mr. Parker, is that they were at parliament.govt address, not the at ministers.govt address. Well, that's an interesting side issue.
Well, yeah, but I'll explore that now. If you're saying that all emails are...
You made a suggestion that using your ministerial inbox to email sensitive data to whoever would be something that would be of concern. My retort was to say that if you were particularising it to me, the emails in question were not sent from my ministerial inbox. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. So it would be a matter of fact, in my opinion, to be determined under the Official Information Act, ultimately by the Ombudsman, as to whether a ministerial document, be it embarrassing or not, to the person who didn't want it disclosed.
That may well be so.
Yeah, okay. Second question, you said that you were surprised that information was coming from parliamentary services to DPMC, if I heard you correctly. And do you have any suggestions?
No, I don't. My point was simply that you have the two bodies, the GCSB and the DPMC, that commissioned an independent report. I was a little surprised to discover that some of the information that the inquiry was seeking during the inquiry was apparently being provided to both. Now, I don't have any... I'm not making any allegation, and I don't have any suspicions as to whom or why, but it just did strike me as a wee bit odd if you're having an independent report.
Did you or your chief of staff, following those communications to DPMC, have representations from Mr. Eagleson asking you to disclose more information?
No. And this is also not part of this inquiry.
Yeah. We've got to be very careful about what we're focusing on in terms of this stage of the inquiry. We're not conducting a hearing into contempt.
Potentially, yes, which was why I wrote, I think from memory, on around the 7th of August to the Speaker, seeking assurances that for that 5-hour, 35-minute period, that the data was not accessed by anyone at all. I have not received a reply at this stage. To it already with the comments regarding the protections around email correspondence. The second element, though, is the much more basic one of the swipe cards. The fact that it is possible, and in this instance did happen, that people's movements in and around this complex were being traced for reasons which were not to do with a criminal matter, not to do with matters of personal safety, but really to do with proving a theory, I think impinges quite dramatically. I mean, I made, and handed to the executive effectively through the provision to the DPMC. I made the comment that wasn't flippant because I've seen the records. Given the structure of Bowen House, it is actually possible to record trips to the bathroom. Now, I find that deeply offensive, frankly, that someone should even be thinking that they can gain access to information which might provide that level of detail to them about someone's movements around a building. All of you should just think how often during the course of a day, so to speak, you would come in and out around this complex and use a swipe card.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if it's important, but I have to wonder whether these rights to privacy or privileges of privileges of individual members of Parliament, or privileges of the protection of Parliament. You know, are we trying to protect Parliament by protecting the rights of individuals?
Well, I would say that they are for the institution, so that's all of the members and people that are within the institution, and I think that where you, my own view is that where you compromise those, it's where you are investigating a criminal matter or there is a matter of serious personal safety involved. I heard Mary Harris make the point about political matters, and I think that this issue comes in. She made the distinction about matters that were inherently of a political nature, and if I heard her correctly, was saying that they shouldn't really form part of the consideration. If that was the view she was expressing, I agree with her.
So how this is given effect to in practice, if someone wants this information, is that in respect of a Member of Parliament, it should be for the Member of Parliament to give up their right to privacy and for no one else to do it on their behalf unless there's some legal right?
In principle, right. Yes.
Yeah. And in respect of journalists, have they got a separate right under the auspices of Parliament or under their rights at the Fourth Estate?
Well, I think journalists and other employees who are working within the complex ought to have a right or some confidence that their rights of free movement around the place aren't going to be abused. And I think by checking, particularly with journalists, who they're going to see, when they might be going to see them, where they might be going to see them, etc., etc., starts to get into this whole area of tracking what the Fourth Estate is up to.
I agree with that. I'm interested in whether, because we're trying to articulate some principles here, whether that arises from Parliament's privileges or the journalist's privilege. And I'm not expecting this.
My sense would be the rules should apply to the institution as a whole.
And that would then cover some third party coming to try and sort of say that some corrupt things happening elsewhere in society.
Potentially, yes. The rights of people who are dealing with Parliament.
Yeah.
Yeah. Transmitted or stored is really secondary.
The reason I get into this is so, you know, if ministers have Gmail accounts or Hotmail accounts or something that's completely off the grid and use that to exchange cabinet papers or just to discuss cabinet papers, that would still be, it would be tested as being official information because it's held by these and our ministers.
Yeah.
So the transmission mechanism, whether it's a parliamentary address or a ministerial address,
but it's the nature of the responsibility that's being exercised.
So the reason that I get to this is ultimately someone needs to make the judgment as to whether it's a parliamentary piece of information or a ministerial piece of information. And then whether if it's a ministerial piece of information, whether there are grounds to withhold it or whether it should be released. And the ultimate arbiter of that is the ombudsman.
Correct.
In the event of complaint.
Yeah.
Official information. Official information.
Yeah.
And making those judgments, should a third party, most notably the ombudsman, be able to access your parliamentary email address to assess whether you have been transmitting information through that? That could be deemed to be official information.
Look, I'm not going to comment on that. I think that's really a matter between the ombudsman and the parliamentary authorities. You know, and the ombudsman is an officer of Parliament anyway.
then and now was that in your mind because of your particular services and as far as I go and the related services, did you raise the matter then or subsequently to discuss it with anybody if you're terrified?
I think it's probably more a case of oversight, to be frank, and I didn't become aware of this until well after the events. A lot of the information started to become available, I think, in the last month or so. So the answer to your second part of the question is no, I didn't, because it was historical at that point.
So at that stage you did not see any distinction between yourself as an
emotionalist? My assumption, and I put that point in the statement simply to, I guess, highlight a point which I made later, which was that there was inconsistency. And I think that in that particular instance, they just didn't line up the records the right way. That's my assumption. I don't think it's anything more sinister than that. But it's just symptomatic of a pretty shoddy, haphazard approach, that's all.
Do you have any questions? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's the last sentence of paragraph 4. And in the first sentence of paragraph 5, which says, no point does the inquiry have any, to have my authorisation, etc., etc. And at what time did you advise the Prime Minister that this was the case?
Sorry?
Well, I want to know is, because we're looking at the process here.
Is this the first page, Mr. Peters?
Yes.
Yeah.
And what's the passage? Sorry.
I'm with you up to the quick. Just to ask the question again.
And if you look at your submission that you've read out, with some verbal added to it as well, but paragraph 4, that's the last sentence which Mr. Graham has read here. And in the first sentence in paragraph 5, what is clear is that at no point did the inquiry have my authorisation, etc., etc.
Yep.
My point is, the Prime Minister had put out an edict. When did you become aware that it applied to you, and when did you know?
Well, that's not really part of the inquiry, Mr. Peters. But I
expect that the chairman will decide that, not you.
I'm saying.
If you want to know about the process of proper or improper disclosure, which is what we are talking about now.
What we're trying to do is we're not holding individuals to account. We're not investigating. Having a rehash of the temporary inquiry.
No, I'm not doing that.
What we're trying to do is look forward. But
I'm trying to find out when it was.
I'm not trying to find out the past. I'm just trying to sort of focus on my statement and start further.
Well, it's getting to the point of order, Mr. Peter's questions aren't going to what was disclosed or not.
That's why I don't.
His questions going to what they disclosed of Mr. Dunn's emails by parliamentary service, and that is exactly what's
going on. Yeah, I've set out in the statement the dates that I'm aware of where certain things happen. In respect of Mr. Peter's question, if you're asking me when was I asked to provide the full content of the emails...
No, I'm asking when did you become aware that the Prime Minister's edict to ministers, which you said didn't come to you, when did you become aware that it was relevant to you?
Oh, that would have been... around the 30th or 31st of May.
And you told the Prime Minister then and said, look, it doesn't apply to me?
No, I did not.
You didn't mind saying it at all?
I did not. Again, we're getting into detail that's probably beyond the scope of the inquiry, but if you just bear with me one moment.
Well, we'll decide on the scope of the inquiry.
Mr. Peters, I'm actually trying to be helpful. Well, and if you just bear with me one moment, I can give you some information that may be of assistance. In fact, Mr. Peters, I can tell you that on the 22nd of May, I was asked to agree to the release of the emails. That I indicated the answer to that question would be no. That led to the meeting with Mr. Henry on the 23rd of May, which I've referred to.
So, basically, they do ask you.
Came via my chief of staff.
Who asked him?
I believe he'd had an inquiry from Mr. Eagleson.
But you did not, anyway, call me or inform me, advise the Prime Minister that you did not agree.
I did not discuss this issue with the Prime Minister at the time, no.
Can I ask this question? You said these
find those where there are criminal matters involved. That is permanent rights.
What case are you referring to, Mr. Peters?
No, not considered in this. Oh, there is. I wrote it down.
Could you elaborate on what you're on?
Well, I'm not sure what the question is. No.
Well, my question is this.
What I think I was referring to is where there was a criminal investigation. This was about access to records. Criminal investigation underway.
Was
or
that in response to my question about CCTV footage?
Yeah, or matters relating to personal safety.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Or security, that's right.
Look, surely whatever rules we eventually evolve here have as our objective to give the truth?
I think, well, that's probably underpins all rules, doesn't it? People have different rights in different circumstances.
Well, can a minister's rights be compromised by their actions?
Oh, this is hypothetical, Mr. Peters, and I'm not really going to comment on that.
Dr. Brown.
Just to sum on one of the previous questions, where you responded that through your chief staff, their request had come into Eagles. So, in light of your earlier comment, that you were surprised that the head of the DPMC was nonetheless actively receiving information during the inquiry. Does it strike you as odd that, in fact, it's not just the DPMC, but actually the Prime Minister's office that is actually...
No, I think the background of that situation was very particular. The Prime Minister's office had given approval on behalf of national ministers for the release of access to certain information. They had declined to give approval in respect of both Mr. Banks and me because we were not members of the National Party. So the courtesy, if you like, was to come to us to say, well, we can't do it for you, you know, what's your answer? And I gave my answer.
Now, if you look, you stood on the record, because you did it, answer this question from Mr. Cosgrove, but in terms of the future process or the issues we're looking at now, is it to be understood by us that there's nothing in those redacted and disclosed emails or the non-disclosed emails that would have any bearing on the head of inquiry or this hearing?
Well, this is outside the scope, Mr. Chairman, and given that my stand was made about privacy, to start discussing the email somewhat compromises that.
Well, no,
but
you
didn't
say...
I ruled it outside the scope.
Well, you can say that, but I don't have to say that. We're going to contest it. We're not having you sitting like somebody with a potentate to make a rule that you know wrong.
No,
because it's already been admitted by the chair that he's been talking about the redacted emails. So it's inside the scope, is it not? Already?
No.
Well, I'll ask you again. Are you saying that nothing you've done whatsoever that you've not disclosed would have been disclosed had a bearing on this inquiry?
Mr. Peters, I'm answering questions related to the purposes of this inquiry. I'm not going to go beyond those.
Well, you can ask me this question then. If it is your contention that there should never be an inquiry in the first place because you didn't make the leak,
repeat my previous answer.
We're now getting into the Henry inquiry stage.
No, we're getting into doing a job that the Henry inquiry bossed up.
No, that's why I read the statement under
we all accept that
one, not as a legal potentate, as the chair, so that we know exactly where we're headed. And you can ask as many questions along those lines as you like, but they're outside the scope of the inquiry. And at the end of the day, I have to, and this committee has to do what the task has asked.
Well, can I ask you then, why did you allow any questions on redacted? Why did you allow questions? Why did you allow questions on redacted emails?
I'm
you want to be consistent.
By neither the legal potentate nor a witness.
Well, consistent.
And the reference to this committee by the Speaker is very clear, and I suggest you read it.
I read it.
Oh, yes.
So why did you allow the redacted email conversation?
Common ground here that something went pretty badly wrong, and other such matters.
succeed for the very reasons that one of your fellow colleagues mentioned at the start of this very hearing.
Right, well, I've ruled on the question for the relevance of these questions, and that's the end.
Can I
ask
a second question?
Mr. Bell,
thank you for your appearance today. When you talk about the information that we have DPMC in this trials, do you want to look into?
No, I don't. Just went to the organisation.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you.